Say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming?
So the war starts out, and you know, the United States has it's pretty easy for us, really. So we sort of invade Canada. Canada's not really prepared for us. You know, the British Army really isn't there. British Army is tied down with Napoleon in Europe. And once Napoleon is defeated, the British send the real army to the United States, right? So then they start harassing the Chesapeake Bay region. And that's when the Battle of Baltimore occurs, and that's where Francis Scott Key is on the boat and wondering what the outcome's going to be. And then hears the gunfire stop and sees the flag the next morning, and that's the inspiration for the Star-Spangled Banner, which was initially called the In Defense of Fort McHenry, or the Defense of Fort McHenry.
Well, so was the Defense of Fort McHenry, did that become a popular song during the War of 1812 then, or did it come out sometime after?
So Key's song is pretty much immediately popular. He actually has it printed in 1,000 broadsides, which is like individual pieces of paper with just the lyrics on it. So one of the points of confusion is, did Key write a song, or did he write a poem that somebody else set to music? In fact, he wrote a song. So what he printed on the paper were lyrics, and then there's a little indication that says tune Anacreon in heaven. So he meant the words to be sung to this British Musicians Club anthem that was written about the time of our own revolution. But that song wasn't really known in the United States until a little bit later, probably the 1790s, and sort of becomes important for American patriotic expression. So it's used for songs for George Washington, or to celebrate, you know, the 4th of July, even before Francis Scott Key writes what we now know as the Star-Spangled Banner.
Did it stay pretty popular, or did it sort of fall by the wayside until we pulled it out for our next conflict?
Well, one of the interesting things about sort of looking at the history of the banner from 1814 to the present, so this 200-year swath of time, is you see the way in which notions of patriotism or American identity, sort of our sense of being a country and being a powerful country, has really changed over time. So in Francis Scott Key's day, the federal government is not particularly powerful, right? So it doesn't have the ability to tax. There's this war debt. It has to sort of call upon the legislature to help pay it off. We have a very weak navy, not a very big army. That's part of the reason why we're not doing so well against the British. I mean, when the real British army shows up, the professionals who've been fighting Napoleon, we can't really respond. And so when we sing the Star-Spangled Banner text today, we think of it as a kind of, you know, maybe a description of who we are. We're this big, powerful, wealthy nation that, you know, can assert its influence really all around the globe. In Francis Scott Key's day, that wasn't really the case. I mean, the notion of the Star-Spangled Banner was not going to instill fear or really much respect, certainly not in the British, right? So his text is a kind of vision for where he hopes the country will go. And part of the reason why the song has been so successful is that Key's aspirations turned out to be correct. But it's really at this time of war when there's a need to pull the country together. And I think that's part of the inspiration that Key feels on September 14th, 1814, when he sees the flag, that, you know, he's looking for that as a symbol of hope, for something to pull the populace together. He's just seen that happen in Baltimore because it's the Baltimore Militia, which is the citizens of Baltimore. The merchants of Baltimore have sunk their ships right out in front of the mouth of the harbor to prevent the British ships from getting in. So they have to basically defeat the Fort McHenry to really gain access. And if they were to gain access to the harbor, they'd be able to use the guns from the ship to support the ground attack that's also going on at the same time. And then the battle would have been over in maybe an hour or two. So it was a pivotal moment in our history. So sometimes we call the War of 1812, when we talk about it, which is not a whole lot, right? We call it the Second War of Independence, because it is a kind of echo, if you will, of the Revolution from 1776. So it's sort of a refighting of the same battle with the same, you know, belligerents. And so had the Battle of Baltimore not gone the way it went, if the British forces had been able to overrun that city as quickly as they'd overrun the national capital a month earlier, we might be in a different country. I mean, it could have reversed that Declaration of Independence that we just celebrated with July 4th.
Well, another war that really gets glossed over in history classes can be the Mexican-American War. And did the anthem play much of a role at that time?
Surprisingly, yeah. So in 1848, with the Mexican-American War, you can really see the way in which these patriotic symbols, both the flag and the song, the Star-Spangled Banner, are being used to, you know, as a kind of battle cry, if you will. So it's the first time that the Stars and Stripes are carried into battle by American troops. It's sort of the first time that the song is deployed. And it's used a lot in sort of newspaper rhetoric. So one of the things that happens with any kind of war is it's not only a war of, you know, soldiers at a physical contest, but it's also an emotional or a philosophical contest.
Sure.
Where ideas are being, you know, put into play against one another. And so you have to win hearts and minds. And so one of the things that was done, I mean, the Mexican-American War is a little bit trumped up, right? I mean, it's a there was strong territorial ambitions on the part of the United States and sort of looking for an excuse to expand the country.
Mm-hmm.
We've, of course, been kicking out Native Americans for decades at this point. And so, I mean, Mexican-Americans and former Spanish colonists, you know, are not treated necessarily all that much better. So the part of it is the rhetoric that's used in Washington by legislators and, you know, calling for a military response, calling for support for funding for the conflict. And a lot of U.S. politicians are actually quoting the Star-Spangled Banner.
Really?
You know, saying, you know, will this be the land of the free? You know, we need to go and invade. We need to attack. We need to respond. Or that the bombs that are being described as being, you know, lofted in the Mexican-American War and then related to the bombs that were on Fort McHenry
okay.
in the same way.
Rockets, so, red glare.
The rockets, red glare. So that same kind of rhetoric is being used to justify the war, to raise money for the war effort, and to, you know, motivate and bring people together behind and in support of the conflict. So there, you know, is in fact another set of lyrics. This word is called the Texas War Cry, which is another, you know, a set of words that are used and are sung to the same tune. Because Texas, of course, is, you know, it's its own country for a while, and then it's sort of part of the United States, and it's Mexican territory. So it's these are lands where identity is shifting mm-hmm. in dramatic ways. And so the anthem is being used as one of those tools to seed and sort of nurture American identity.
Hmm. That seems quite fitting, since the poem itself was actually written to fit another tune. Just keep on writing verses that fit.
Yeah, I think one of the more surprising parts of my research is that, and it almost happens on a daily or at least weekly basis, that I'm coming across another set of lyrics that was sung, especially in the 19th century, to the same tune. So it's actually part of a really common cultural practice called the broadside ballad, where new lyrics are published in a newspaper broadside,
okay.
and then sung to popular tunes that everybody would have known. So if we, you know, wrote new lyrics for Take Me Out to the Ball Game or Happy Birthday or, you know, any of those songs today, you know, you could immediately sing a new set of words to that same melody because everybody knows it. So it's a part of, you know, the way in which ideas were shared and debated and negotiated was to actually put them into music, not so much to convey the meaning of the words, but to convey the emotional import of the words. So something as sort of deep as love of country, that patriotic sentiment,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can use music as a way of sort of reaching the hearts of people as well as their minds by putting these sort of claims of American hopes and dreams into a song.
Even when you're sort of invading another country and taking their land. Less of a glorious reason there, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, so that's the Star-Spangled Banner as a unifying force, whereas in the Civil War, the country itself was split. So how did the Star-Spangled Banner play a role in that?
Well, this was fascinating to me, and also a real surprise, is that both the North and the South claimed the Star-Spangled Banner as their own.
Yet another thing.
Right.
So it's states' rights, it's slavery. Mm-hmm. And it's the Star-Spangled Banner.
And it's the Star-Spangled Banner. I mean, there were people in the Confederacy who argued, you know, these are our symbols. They're honored symbols. We haven't betrayed the Union, right? It's the Northerners who've elected this Lincoln guy who've betrayed us. So we have to – not only are these our symbols, but we need to protect them from the desecration
of these ideological warfare,
right,
too.
On both sides, really. So, you know, I would say that the voices who were in support of keeping, like, Hail Columbia, the Star-Spangled Banner, the flag, those kinds of things in the Confederacy, you know, did not succeed for very long, in part because since the Union troops were marching around with the Stars and Stripes, you know, at the head of their
yeah.
military columns, it's difficult to continue singing the song that refers to a symbol being used by the,
right.
the North. But, I mean, one of the, actually, you know, when you talk about the battle for hearts and minds in a war, I mean, one of the strengths that the North had was not only industrial power and the ability to manufacture guns, but it was actually printing power and the ability to publish pamphlets and newsletters and songs. So there were many, many more songs published in the North than were published in the South, just because of the printing capabilities of the North. So there's, if you add up bullets and guns, it favors the North. But if you add up songs, it also favors the North. And I think in many ways, that was an important part of the Civil War. So there actually are Confederate lyricists who are writing new texts to the Star-Spangled Banner and saying things like, oh, say, can't you see, you know, and that those stars, you know, that the flag that you so, you know, saw yesterday is so vaunting and gleaming. So these kinds of words that were mocking Northern sort of ideology, but using words that actually sort of echo and parody the Star-Spangled Banner as a way of cutting it down to size, if you will. The South didn't initially have its own sort of anthem, if you will. So it actually used the Marseillaise. The French national anthem is one of the musical symbols of the Confederacy because they saw themselves as revolutionaries, again, as sort of holding to the truth.
Dixie comes to mind.
Dixie, ironically, that's a Northern song.
Oh, gosh.
You know, that was picked up by the South. Bonnie Blue Flag is another one that was used by the South. So there's a lot of musical battles going on through the sound, the airwaves, as well as sort of the bullets flying through the airwaves. The North, I think one of the things you start to see in the Civil War, it's an important moment in the history of both our flag and our anthem, because it's at this point that we start to see the kind of sacred aspects of the song coming in. I mean, initially, Francis Scott Key's song is a party tune, right? It's a victory song. It's like, hey, we won. We beat the British, you know. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? It's very fast. It's in triple time. It's with the Civil War and the sacrifices, the literal blood sacrifices that Americans are making to preserve the Union, that we start to see the Union as something really sacred, as something that can't be violated, that you can't leave. That's a bond that can't be broken. And I think the flag symbolizes that and the song gains that. So over time, I mean, today we sing the national anthem as a kind of hymn. I mean, it's almost kind of a spiritual experience.
It's much more solemn.
It's much more solemn. It's sort of majestic. So that sort of slow tempo that has the dotted notes in it, you know, things like that, that's slow communal singing down, that give this more spiritual, almost hymn-like quality. Even at times singing it in 4-4 time, which for, you know, is much closer to a church hymn than the original 3-4 sort of waltz-like feeling. But you start to see this transition during the Civil War, and one of the bits of evidence of this is that the lyricists from the North are not replacing Francis Scott Key's words, but rather they're adding to them. So you have Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., so his son, Jr., becomes a Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. influential jurist. But his father is a leading thinker and author and, I think, physician. But one of the things he does in 1861 for July 4th is he actually writes a fifth verse, adding on to the four written by Francis Scott Key. And this fifth verse, among other things, calls for the freeing of the slaves, for breaking the chains of bondage. And that fifth verse by Holmes actually gets used in these basically official government publications. So John Philip Sousa, the famous bandmaster who was with the Marine Band, ends up publishing a book of national anthems in 1889. And he actually includes Oliver Wendell Holmes' verse is number 5 in the sort of patriotic song of the United States, which is the Star-Spangled Banner. So I think by extending the anthem and by not changing Francis Scott Key's words, we see a kind of reverence sort of starting for both flag and for the song. And really in the aftermath of the Civil War, we don't see these kind of parodies happening much at all. I mean, it's sort of like I think there's a kind of musical a period of a musical truce, if you will, you know, where we do, you know, when the anthem is played in the South, it's often paired with Dixie in the post-war period as a way of sort of acknowledging Southern pride, acknowledging sort of the Confederate sacrifice, but then playing the Star-Spangled Banner right after, sort of asserting kind of the overarching national identity and also probably federal power. It's part of that. So there's a lot of social dynamics that are communicated in music, a lot of, you know, relationships that are articulated by song.
Do you know what the reaction like during Reconstruction, if there is a tradition of the Star-Spangled Banner becoming more prominent or being, you know, forced down their throats? Or
It's certainly performed. I mean, there's a couple sets of lyrics that happen right at the very end of the war in 1865 that are basically saying, you know, this rift will never heal. We're never going to get beyond this. This is no longer our song. It could never, you know, the Star Spangled Banner can't represent.
And that's coming from the South.
It's coming from the South. There's a song in 1862 called Farewell to the Star Spangled Banner. It's a different song entirely, but it's, again, using that same, you know, rhetoric of we have, this has changed everything. You know, we can't go back. What I see is a kind of echo sort of 10, 25 years later. There's something called the Grand Army of the Republic, which is a very influential group in U.S. politics in the later 19th century, which is made up of Civil War veterans. And they're certainly keeping patriotism alive. There are concerts that happen sort of on the 20th, 25th anniversary of the Civil War. They're going to be playing both the sounds of North and South. There's a kind of ritual healing that happens by playing patriotic songs. Where I really see it start to change is actually with Columbus Day. So Columbus Day was invented, if you will, in 1892. So it's was celebrating the 400th anniversary of Columbus's quote-unquote discovery of America.
Okay.
That actually leads to a new spark of patriotism in the country. That I think after the Civil War, there's a kind of downplaying of patriotic sentiment because it sort of awakens old wounds.
Sure.
So with Columbus Day, one of the things we're doing is actually trying to sort of finally heal that rift. And it's happening largely with public schools, right? So, you know, there are all these new sort of books. The Pledge of Allegiance is created at this time, and it's really distributed to school kids. And so the idea of, you know, pledging allegiance to the flag, of singing the Star Spangled Banner, is inculcated in the early 1890s, such that when we get to the next big war, the Spanish-American War in 1898, which is often called sort of the moment of healing of the Civil War, right? Mm-hmm. We sort of have finally, we bring all the country together against a common enemy, the Spanish, and I don't think that's actually true. I think in some ways the Spanish-American War takes advantage of the groundwork that has been laid, you know, earlier in the decade by the celebration of Columbus Day and sort of this reawakening of American patriotism, largely in young people, because, of course, young people didn't fight in the Civil War, right?
Right.
So they're removed from it, sort of maybe able to get beyond it a little better. But by the time we get certainly to the Spanish-American War, which, of course, is a little bit like the first Gulf War. It's really quick. It's 10 weeks long. It's sort of this overwhelming victory from the United States. And so it makes war seem easy. It makes, you know, the expression of American international power seem easy. I mean, this time we have a strong navy. We beat the Spanish empires in decline. We suddenly get all these colonies, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Cuba, you know, so we become an international force sort of overnight, building on all the changes with the Industrial Revolution that have happened in the United States. So that's a moment really of, I would think, of blossoming of sort of patriotism in a kind of national sense, recovered from the Civil War, but that blossom required, you know, the plant, if you will, if we continue with this metaphor.
Sure.
Not sure it's a good idea, but let's go with it. If that plant had to grow before, and it was really growing sort of in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that really continues after the Spanish-American War. It's music educators, the Bureau of Education, sort of the National Education Association, I think, which are starting to ask, like, well, what is the how do we sing the Star Spangled Banner? Because when I get people together and I have them sing it, everybody sings it in a slightly different way.
Right.
Because it's really part of oral tradition as much as anything.
Yeah.
So people know how it goes. They just sing it. But there's, I mean, remember, although recording is invented in 1877, we don't have mass media. We don't have radio. We can't go to YouTube and just check out the latest version, see how so-and-so sang it at the last Super Bowl.
Right.
So there's a lot more variability in the way individuals sing the song. And so it's really music educators who sort of say, okay, well, I guess we have to come up with an official version. So I think the New York public schools publish a version. And these start to gain traction, so much so that by the time we get to World War I, we actually have sort of two groups that are creating semi-official versions of the national anthem. One is coming off of the Music Supervisors National Conference, which is now NAFME, the National Association for Music Education. They're working on one. And they've actually got what they call the Committee of 12. So, you know, of course, if it's going to be institutionalized, you got to have a big committee, I guess. but they, you know, they have a couple composers on there, and they come up with their version that's sort of sanctioned by the U.S. military. It's called the service version, still performed today. Then there's another version that John Philip Sousa, Oscar Sonic, who's at the music librarian at the Library of Congress, and then Walter Domrosch, who's the conductor of the New York Symphony, are all involved with. And they actually... they create a version where they each of them writes down what they think the Star Spangled Banner is. So they have five versions of it right next to each other with the music notation. And then they sort of average everything out to come up with a normal version or a standardized version, as they call it. And then these start being, you know, printed and reprinted by music publishers who are really trying to make a lot of money, right? So
sure.
they're basically saying our version's the best version. So ironically, there is no traditional version of the Star Spangled Banner, because what we sing today is not what Francis Scott Key sang.
Was using, right.
Right. I mean, the melody is a different shape. The notes are slightly different. I mean, you'd still recognize it.
Sure.
But it's not precisely the same. If we were to sing it, if someone were to sing it at a football game in the way Francis Scott Key would have, everybody would sort of look quizzically at each other and wonder what they're supposed to do, because it's just a little different enough that it would be confusing. So you can't go back to the original version, because the original version isn't what we're used to.
Right.
Right. So the anthem is really built, in a sense, by social practice. It's built by people repeating and rehearsing and sort of deepening the relationship of tune to American identity. It's not built by, you know, legislative act or a creative act. It's not, you know, written by a composer. It's really sort of co-created, if you will. And it's these times of war when there's a feeling of threat, when there's something that really needs to bring us together, that we start to, I think, depend on music as a way to provide emotional solace and comfort, but also a sense of we're in this together, mm-hmm. we're strong, we're united. And the ritual of singing the anthem, you know, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, but it's like the feeling of being together and the coming together are produced by the song. And as the country gets bigger, as the threats get bigger, if you will, with technology and, you know, warplanes, which we didn't have in the Civil War,
right.
we suddenly have in World War I. We have bigger and bigger bombs, obviously, by World War II. I mean, in some ways, the anthem becomes even more important. So I would say it's World War I. You know, that sort of sanctity of the song and the sacrifice of it, the way in which the flag and the stars become a symbol of union in the Civil War is maybe the beginnings, if you will, of this effect. But where it really comes to fruition is in World War I. Because World War I is a war that's sort of far away. It's in Europe. You know, you can't fly there in a commercial flight. You can't watch the news and see video from there at this time. So it feels very far away. So one of the ways in which people who wanted to encourage American intervention into World War I, because of course we sort of come relatively late to the party, and once we show up, the war changes relatively quickly.
Right.
So, you know, it's a big, awful war with enormous casualties, but it's also the United States is only in it for a little over a year. So it's relatively, compared to some of the other countries' involvement, relatively easy for us. But it is far away, and so national anthems and singing sort of the French national anthem and the Belgian national anthem and the anthems of our allies, the British national anthem, are things that galvanize the whole country. And, of course, you can't sing their anthem without singing our anthem. And so our anthem becomes more and more important. One of the funny things or interesting things maybe about these official versions of that are put out in World War I is that they all drop verse 3 from Francis Scott Key's original. So
really?
If you look at a World War I imprint of the anthem, it'll – of course, today we only sing the first verse, right? But there are four.
Right.
And of course, the bad guys in the War of 1812 were the British, right? In World War I, the British are our allies, right? They're the good guys. And so verse 3, which talks about the, you know, the harming and slave and sort of the anti-British verse of Key's original, has been sort of silently removed from our own.
So it was the sign of the times at that moment.
Yep, we exactly.
Okay, excised it out of what, courtesy?
Yeah, I guess. Well, if you're going to build support for your allies, you don't want to insult them at the
same
time.
In the same song that you're, right, that
exactly.
makes sense. But it wasn't the official national anthem at that time.
That's right.
So how did that become, who brings that to Congress? Who starts it?
So it's Charles Linthicum, who's a senator from Maryland. So Maryland and, you know, where Baltimore is, where Baltimore Harbor is, where the Battle of Baltimore and Fort McHenry is, have always been and continue to be strong advocates for the memory of the War of 1812 and for, you know, the Star-Spangled Banner, the song, and the Garrison flag, which is now, of course, in the Smithsonian, what was originally flying above the fort, and that was what Francis Scott Key saw. So really the state of Maryland has been a cheerleader, if you will, for, you know, the recognizing the Star-Spangled Banner as the one and only national anthem of the United States. And that recognition doesn't occur until March 3rd of 1931, so really pretty late. I mean, it hasn't even been 100 years. The song had been around for 116 years at that point.
And it's already seen us through how many wars?
Right. So, as I said, I mean, I think it's effectively the national anthem already by the way people treat it, mm-hmm. but there's no official government law saying that it is, right? So there's a little bit of ambiguity. This causes trouble for the American military, right? Because they're the ones who, especially the Navy, shows up at port of call in a foreign country.
And they're supposed
Navy bands are almost always aboard ship. Uh-huh. And so there's this, you know, meeting of dignitaries where the captain of the ship meets the mayor, the governor of the place they're visiting. Usually there's a musical accompaniment to that kind of ritual. Nobody's sure what to play. Right? Do you play Hail Columbia? Do you play Yankee Doodle? Do you play the Star-Spangled Banner? And certainly the Star-Spangled Banner and Hail Columbia in the 19th century are sort of the two leading candidates. And I would say before the Civil War, Hail Columbia wins out more often. After the Civil War, Star-Spangled Banner starts winning out more often. Certainly by World War I, it's only the Star-Spangled Banner. Hail Columbia has almost disappeared really by that time. So it's but it is important for the U.S. military to, like, know what to do.
Right.
Right. And so it's actually the U.S. military on January 8th, 1917, there's an Army regulation that actually is the first sort of government document that says the Star-Spangled Banner is the, quote, national anthem, end quote. It's sort of said that Woodrow Wilson endorses that, but I haven't found a piece of paper yet that has his signature on it. But it is military regulation, and since the president is the, you know, commander-in-chief,
right,
in a sense,
and that's
Wilson.
Implicit.
And Wilson's daughter, Margaret, actually made a record of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was sold to benefit the Red Cross. And so So his presidency certainly wraps into this whole story. But it's not until the 1920s it's really around World War I that we start looking – the individual congressmen, particularly from Maryland, are introducing bills to recognize the song as the anthem. But, you know, this is not a pressing issue.
Sure.
Like in the middle of the war, it's not a big issue. You know, during the boom time afterwards, like, who wants to stop – the Roaring Twenties to really think about the anthem. You know, this
right.
is not a big deal. And basically the government sort of says, well, you know, we all know what song to sing. Everybody, you know.
So it's more of a formality.
Head
to head.
But there are some conflicts. So on one hand, there's inaction because it's just really not that critical an issue to deal with. On the other hand, there's an action because there are also people who would object to it. So if you're a music teacher, for example, you may not really love the Star-Spangled Banner because it's got this really wide melodic compass of a 12th.
I've noticed that.
Right? So it takes a lot of energy to sing. It takes a pretty good voice. Makes a lot of sense for Francis Scott Key with his Victory Party song to want a strong, athletic, sort of bold, audacious melody.
Yeah.
But, you know, compared to, say, God Save the King or O Canada or something like that, you know, which have a melodic compass, I think, of a sixth and an octave. Marseillaise is just a ninth. So the Star-Spangled Banner is pretty much wider, bigger than everybody, every other anthem. So it's not really meant for, you know, group singing. It's meant for a really superstar soloist more so than a big group. So that's one objection. If you are a nationalist, you may not like it because it's based on this London Musicians Club tune. You know,
it should be American,
right? You
know,
why would we use a British tune? For me, I sort of feel like we use the English language, so that using the English melody, maybe not such a big deal. We are culturally British, but you know, some people are upset about that. If you're a prohibitionist, and of course, the 1920s were the time of prohibition in the United States, the melody gets used for drinking songs right after it gets used for this club anthem. So there's this sort of nasty association.
Bad
so that's a good way to dump on the Star Spangled Banner is to say it's a drinking song. If you're, you know, a pacifist, you're not so hot on the song either. You know, in the 1920s, again, we're sort of between now the world wars, but we were isolationists. We didn't want to get involved. You know, Europe's problems was Europe's problem. You know, we didn't really want to have anything to do with that. So the last thing a pacifist wants is a song that gets people really excited and galvanizes them to go to war,
right,
which is what the Star Spangled Banner functions as, you know, probably more often than we'd like in our culture. So, you know, again, there's lots of reasons to object to it. But as I say, it wasn't really up to Congress. I mean, this really is a sort of democracy in action story because it was the people, in a sense, who make this the national anthem by what they choose to sing at what time, where they find identity, especially as the country gets bigger and you don't know all your neighbors. You can't shake the hand of every other American, right? So you need symbols. You need just ideas to bring us together. So song is one of the ways in which those symbols and ideas are shared. World War II becomes a really important time for the anthem as well. I mean, at this point, it is the official national anthem. But one of the things that starts to shift in World War II is that's the first time we get into this ritual of playing the anthem at every single sporting event, right? So before that time, you would do the anthem, you know, maybe once for a season, for opening day, for maybe the All-Star game, for the big championship. Because, you know, before the invention of loudspeakers, you know, which comes in the late 20s, the only way to have an anthem at a sporting event is to have a live band, right? And of course, bands require musicians, which require to be paid, right? So it really
too expensive.
It
to
was
have
pretty
them
expensive.
At every
so you did it on special occasions. You didn't do it every single game, right? But in World War I and a little bit before, it really becomes common to be playing the anthem at every single game to support the war effort, and then, you know, by the way, also support the economic interests of the sports leagues, right? Because one of the things you could say is, you know, we're rationing gasoline, we're rationing rubber for the war effort. Let's stop having all these professional sports games because, you know, we have to keep the lights on at night. People have to drive in their cars to go to the stadium. They're using up valuable resources. There's an argument there for let's just eliminate sports and this kind of entertainment, you know, during a time of conflict when we got more important things to do. So by associating sort of patriotism with commercial sports, you also say, well, it's American, like apple pie,
right,
Chevrolet,
right,
to be baseball, right? So you can't cancel baseball. It's the time that brings people together. It's fundamental to being American, right? And so a lot of that stuff gets wrapped up. And, you know, political candidates have known this for a long time, right? They are constantly bathing themselves in patriotic symbols. But a lot of political candidates, going back to Thomas Jefferson, William Henry Harrison, Abraham Lincoln, you know, all used campaign songs sung to the tune of the national anthem for the exact same reason, because they wanted to make it a good patriotic thing to do to vote for them, right? So these kinds of associations get used and sometimes abused in different ways.
You're kind of bumming me out.
Sorry about that. Yeah, there's this sort of dark side to the national anthem. It's not just all dawn's early light.
I mean, I guess something, the national anthem has to be used for propagandist reasons, but I don't like to think of it as propaganda because I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it too. The more
you know?
I hear it, the more I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't want it to just be an excuse for, you know, like baseball to get to keep going. I don't want it to be a trick to make me vote for Abraham Lincoln, although I totally would have voted for Abraham Lincoln. But That's a really interesting perspective.
Well, I mean, one of the things that'll redeem it, I guess, maybe for you is the, you know, sort of the Korean War, the Vietnam War, where war starts to become controversial in the United States. We also see both the right and the left using the Star Spangled Banner, right? So it becomes, you know, in some ways our, especially if we go back to people like Jefferson, right, you know, that the tree of liberty has to be watered by revolution, right? We want dissent. We want debate. We want – it's patriotic to question authority in the United States.
Right. Right.
So, you know, the student movement is using the Star Spangled Banner, is carrying flags around. I mean, it's amazing to me, you know, when I look back at, like, rock and roll bands in the 1960s, you know, you'll see, like, the MC5 or the Grateful Dead. You know, they'll have – the Star Spangled Banner behind them, right? It's because rock and roll and revolution and patriotism were, you know, commenting on the country, sometimes in ironic ways maybe, but certainly part of it. And, you know, Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock is maybe the great example.
Sure.
But there are many others. I mean, Jose Feliciano at the 1968 World Series and Marvin Gaye at the NBA All-Star Game. You know, they're all putting their own spin on the Star-Spangled Banner. So for me, it's always, whenever it's performed, it's, you know, we're making a claim that this is our song. And the people that notion of our, or, you know, that the notion of American represents, are, of course, it's this incredibly diverse people with a lot of different ideas about what's right and wrong and what's best and what's not. And so, you know, I think it's great. One of the things I love about that 1931 bill that makes the anthem our official anthem is that it basically just says the song known as the Star-Spangled Banner is the national anthem of the United States, period. It's the end of the whole
shortest
thing.
Legislation ever.
Pretty close, right? So there's no it's not like these words sung to this musical arrangement played by four trumpets, three trombones, two clarinets. You know, it's not legislating exactly how it's done.
Right.
So at least as far as the U.S. government's concerned, Jimi Hendrix on an electric guitar at Woodstock is just as cool as the Detroit Symphony at Greenfield Village, you know, playing for the 4th of July.
Right,
so it's all American. That's
all
the anthem, right? So I think that's really important because it gives you the chance to make this sincere claim to what you hope is great about the country, right? So we sing our love of the nation when we perform that, but what people think the nation is not necessarily exactly the same thing. And it's that ability of the symbol to adjust, because of course the people who say, if you look, compare 1814 to today, right, and Francis Scott Key being a slave owner, right,
mm-hmm.
to being one of the founders of the American Colonization Society, which sent, you know, slaves back to Africa. He represented free blacks, but he also represented slave owners in his legal practice. So it's complicated, that history. So there's a whole group that, you know, that weren't Americans in 1814 that are Americans today. In terms of political power, women couldn't vote in 1814, you know, but they can today. So there's, our democracy is enlivened by the fact that it's flexible, and I think the song sort of flexes in that way. But there is a really, you know, powerful, I would say, nationalist side to the Star-Spangled Banner that can, and it's sort of, I guess, as a democracy, it's what we do with that power that's really the key. So one of the things, you know, it's maybe my strongest memory of the Star-Spangled Banner is when it disappeared. So right at 9/11, that morning, I just remember it well. I was at home and I heard about the Twin Towers and watching on television. But pretty much the Star-Spangled Banner disappeared from the airwaves at that moment, and God Bless America became the song that we were singing. Because
yeah.
It was something that brought the country together, but it was a sense of shock, a sense of mourning. We needed sort of national solace. It wasn't a sense of unity. I mean, it was unity, but it was a different temperature, right?
Right.
It was a softer, cooler temperature. When the United States then went to war in Afghanistan and sort of reacting to that terrorist attack, along with the cruise missiles, sort of was launched, you know, the reinvigoration of the national anthem of the Star-Spangled Banner, because it was that point that we were becoming more sort of extroverted than introverted, when we were pushing power outside, when we needed to bring the country together. Sort of for resistance or to fight for you know, in response to that attack. And that's where the anthem really comes back. So one of the things I sometimes hear people say is, oh, I wish we could have a different anthem. I wish we could have, you know, some of those other candidates in 1931
mm-hmm.
were like Yankee Doodle or Hail Columbia or Columbia Jim and the Osen. But maybe the most popular one I hear people talk about is America the Beautiful, right? Because that's the song. It's sort of uncontroversial, right? It talks about sort of, you know, from sea to shining sea, and it's all this
the
natural beauty and
the
landscape.
Yeah.
And that's a very, you know, common patriotic trope. But it also doesn't that song, America the Beautiful, wouldn't work for those moments of crisis, right?
Yeah.
Where you really need to bring people together. And I think the Star-Spangled Banner is something that can respond because of the energy, because of the difficulty in singing that song, because in some ways the musical commitment it takes, the strength it takes to perform it, it also kind of evokes that strength in the American psyche to respond to external, you know, threats of international relation or natural disasters or things like that. So it's that ability of the song to galvanize us as a people that I think is really, in many ways, what will assure the fact that the Star-Spangled Banner will be the song we continue to sing as our national anthem for at least as long as I can imagine.